about at the end of the Amud in the English, it's 25A5. 25A5. Now we are at that section in the Gemara where we are entering now a sizely sugya, which is devoted to eulogies. To eulogies said by different people in different circumstances. And you'll see this is it's both charming and interesting. Okay? Ki nach nafshai hu derav barhun varav hamenunha. When, now there are two deaths of two Babylonian rabbis. One was zero in on the Hebrew, the Aramaic, nach nafsho, in Talmudic Hebrew means died. Their soul rested. And nafshaiho means, that's the plural, nafshotehem, the souls of, the plural souls of. When the souls of Rabba Bar Huna and Rab Hamanuna rested, which is to say when these two rabbis died, askinu la'ata, they, askinu means he'elum, they brought them up to the land of Israel. Atan sham, from the perspective of the Babylonian rabbis, means the land of Israel. Okay? So they were brought up together. Kimatu agishra. We're now at the top of 25B. When they came to a bridge, Labriot, when they came to a bridge, apparently they must have been going along side by side. If they now come to a bridge, Kamu Gamle, the camels that were carrying them stopped. Camels stopped. The assumption here is, and I assume it has to do with rank also, that one wasn't carried in front of the other. You have two biers, and they're carried side by side in order not to clearly pay any more respect or kavod to one than to the other. Whoever would be first would have the more respect, one would assume. So and they get to the bridge. The bridge must have been narrow, and they couldn't keep going. So the camel stopped. Kamu gamle. The camels stood still. Amalaho autaya. The camels must have been led by an Arab. A taya is an Arab. Right? So the Arab then, he speaks. An Arab speaks. Amalaho autaya. The Arab then says to them, to them probably meaning to the people who are with the beers. Now keep in mind, you're reading the Talmud now, and we're in, let's say, the late 3rd century CE, so you're way before Islam. And you're talking about, you're talking about Arabs who are pagans. This is a pagan world, and that's what you're dealing with. The Arab says, my high. In other words, what's going on here? What's going on here? Amru lay, they replied, Rabbanan deka avde yakara ahadabe. The rabbis, they replied that they must be the people, the Jews, who were accompanying these two rabbis in their coffins. So the Jews says to the Jews say to the Arab, Rabbanan de yakara ahadade, harabanim nichabim ze et ze. The rabbis are paying honor to one another. And he fleshes it out. Maramar marneo beresha. One of them says, you go first. Okay, umaramar marneo beresha. The other one says, you go first. So they were being courteous to these two dead rabbis were being courteous to each other. The stories are, you know, the living, the dead are as if they are alive in these stories. So they say, you go first. No, you go first, okay? And the Arab is sort of perplexed by the whole thing that the camels have stumps. Amar, the Arab says, Dinu hu de rabba bar huna le'o bereisha. He says, Dina, hadin hu. In other words, it makes more sense, makes most sense, that rabba bar huna, he should go first. Now, how does an Arab know that? You know, in a way, it's just all so absurd here. Obviously, Arab would never know that. But the Arab is the one who says it, you know. He makes the conclusion about it. He draws this conclusion. Now, the Rashi, see if I can find the Rashi here. If you look at the Rashi Ketav Yad, the Rashi manuscript, remember on the very inside here is the manuscript edition of Rashi, the Hebrew side of the page, and it's the same on all these pages, the very inner, next to the margin, next to the binding, is called Rashi Ketav Yad. Rashi manuscript. Right, this is the actual Rashi, apparently. This is not the pseudo Rashi, this is the real Rashi. And if you look there, just about six lines down into that, Taya, it says, Socher Yishmael, an Arab merchant. He's translating the Aramaic word Taya. Rabbanan, Shachfe Havu. The dead rabbis were paying respect to each other. Because one doesn't want to go in front of his fellow. Right? He wants to be respectful to him. Mar Amar, Shchiv Amar Lahadadi, that is to say, one of the dead people says to the other, Bedina, that's what I wanted to in particular look at. Bedina, Hare Lefi Da'ati. Right? The Arab is saying, according, in my opinion, somewhere there is. Okay, well, we'll read a little bit. Keep your finger, if you have it in the Rashi there. Go back to the text for a minute, and then I want to go back to the Rashi too. So the rabbi says, the Arab says, Dina hu de rabba bar huna le'ol bereisha. It stands to reason that rabba bar huna should go first. Chalif gamle de rabba bar huna. And in fact, the camel of rabba bar huna went first. So the camel must have heard. Either the camel heard, or the rabbi heard, or somebody heard, and the camel suddenly just takes off and crosses the bridge. Okay? The end of the story is, Nator kache deshine daha utaya. The Arab's molars and teeth fell out. That is quite an end to a story, somebody's teeth fall out. I don't know about you, but it reminds me, my grandmother used to say things like that. You know, may his... That tell us what that is?
All of your teeth should fall out, but one should remain, and in that one you should have a toothache.
A good Yiddish curse, exactly. So I think you're seeing an early layer of that kind of cursing, or what precursors the curses. Okay,
precursors to the curses. Steinzel points out that the Aravi's thing was based on the fact that he was the son of a great man.
Well, here, that's why I want you to go back now to the Rashi.
Okay.
Go back to the Rashi manuscript. the Russian manuscript says, after Bedina, Bedina was, it makes sense, Hare Lefi Da'ati, according to my opinion. Next, the Rashi manuscript says, Gavra Bar Gavra Le'ol. Now that we don't have in our text. Gavra Bar Gavra Le'ol. This is the Arab speaking. Let a man who is the son of a man go first. Okay? Ish Ben Ish. Or Rav Ben Rav. Okay, that's probably more the force of it. Rashi says, Ari ben Ari, the lion, the son of a lion. All right, that's Gavra bar Gavra, the lion, the son of a lion. In other words, there's Rabba Babar Huna. Huna, we had already seen, I don't know if you remember, last time we were together, 2 weeks ago, we had seen several stories about Huna as this great Babylonian rabbi. Huna was the great Babylonian rabbi. So now we're dealing a generation later with the death of Rabba Bar Huna. Rabba, the son of Huna. Okay? So here you've got two generations of great rabbis. We know then he's called Rabba Bar Huna. You know who Huna was. So the Rashi manuscript now points that out. It says, Ari ben Ari, and then he says here, Hagirsa etzlenu de Rabba bar Huna le'ol. Then in this edition of the manuscript it says, but in our Talmudic text, namely not the manuscript, Rashi must have had a different text of the Talmud. So Rashi's text of the Talmud said, Gavra bar Gavra. Our text simply doesn't have that, so it's not explaining it. Okay? But it makes more sense if the Arab actually filled it in with that we're talking Gavra ba Gavra, and then according to Rashi, Ari ben Ari, lion, the son of a lion. Is that basically what Steinfeld says?
All he says is the phrase that I use, which is Shekein hu v'no shel adam gadol.
Okay, so that's it.
Same thing.
Not three
Schottenstein also references
it. Yes, he references that, which is in the Rashi manuscript. There's a great man. In Yaakov, the text reads explicitly, I bedina didi gavra bar gavra le'ol bereisha. That's what I read you from Rashi. Here, that seems to be the version in the Rashi manuscript. Okay, that's what he has there. Now, of course, the odd thing here, I don't know, sir. Odd things, if there's only one odd thing. The oddest of the odd things is what happens to the Arab, that his teeth fall out. So that has perplexed all of the readers of the passage, because the question is, what did he do wrong? Yeah. Assumption is that he's being punished.
We don't know what would have happened to him if he chose the other one. It
would have
been worse.
Certainly is possible.
Maybe they would have fallen out anyway.
Yeah. I mean, it seems in a story like this, when you have the punchline, and the Arab's teeth, plus his molars fell out, I don't know.
Could it be perhaps just the idea that he decided to choose?
Of course. That's the
first matter who it is. And
I think most likely possibility is, who are you to put your 2 cents in a case of presumptuous? You're presumptuous. There are two great rabbis here. They're talking it out between each other, between themselves. And who are you to put your 2 cents in here? We see that frequently, the rabbis. A young rabbi, is not allowed to make a decision in front of his teacher because it's presumptuous. It's an indication of yohara, of arrogance when you do things like that. So it seems to me that that's probably what's going on here. But it's not the only possibility.
I assume that the Arab was leading the camels and that he gave preference to the older of the two, which is what happened in not only Arab, but all society. You gave the kavod first to the older person.
The older camel?
The older camel or the older person?
The older, the one who got to be older.
Could be. Right. The manuscript here, of course, has a logic to it. The manuscript logic is that the Arab knew that Rabbi Bar Barahuna had more of a pedigree than Rav Hamanuna. Right? Hamanuna's name doesn't include a patronymic, whereas Rabbi Bar Barahuna, because he had such a famous father, the son was always known by his father's name. Okay?
I would suggest maybe facetiously that you could take it in the modern sense that the Arab's jaw dropped out of amazement that the camel heard what he said and did what he said.
That's a very good idea.
Could
I just need a little bit of Bil'am? Mm-hmm. That's a good idea. Go ahead. Finish what you said.
Before came this, in note 4 says, Rashi interprets one of the words as jaw. So it could be like you say, the jaw drops out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's an in amazement. Right, the Arab was just so amazed by the whole thing.
The camel listened to him.
And correct. That's a very nice interpretation. Very nice interpretation. Okay.
In the previous story, which was the story about Rav Huna, when they brought him into Palestine to be buried, he was using an occupied crypt, and the two sons of Rav Huna got up and got into a discussion also.
Correct.
Is this something that comes up pretty frequently, or is this a...
I wouldn't say frequently, but you will find it. And you find it here. I mean, it's not unique to here, but of course it's the material of, generally speaking, when you get toward the end of a chapter, you get more agadic material than the beginning of a chapter. And I think part of what we're beginning to see is that we're coming to the end of the chapter. We're also coming to the end of the Masechet. So that the likelihood that we'll get more agadah is greater. Just the editing of the text seems to put this stuff there. Yeah. Plus, the subject matter lends itself to it. Okay, and indeed, you get this. You get the dead speaking. I would have said I was tempted to say that it's a Babylonian phenomenon. That's not true. I mean, here you do. This is a story of Babylonian rabbis, as was the previous story. Those are Babylonians. I assume that the Babylonian story
is a lot of Judaism. Is there an idea that we are not around in the, somehow in the cemetery conversations are taking place among the deceased?
That's been a question ever since the time of the early Talmud. We have no answer to that question, but it's a discussion that never ceases. We had that, I don't know how many of you remember, we had a passage like that in Brachot. It's a long time ago. It's an amazing story about two people talking in the grave, and they're debating a subject, and then they fly around at night, and it's a very weird story. It's a story that's as you would call it, a Palestinian story. By that I mean it's not a Babylonian story. Years ago, Lady Ginsberg, Louis Ginsberg wrote an article called Introduction to the Palestinian Talmud. It's found in the book Jewish Law and Lore by Louis Ginsberg. Ginsberg was one of the great Talmudists of the 20th century. He was professor at the seminary, died before my time. He was the teacher of people like Rabbi Nedich. Louis Ginsberg wrote him. He's the author of
Stories of Jews.
Legends of the Jews, a multi-volume work, which was condensed. We have it here, and a Legends of the Jews by Ginsberg, where he puts into sort of logical or narrative order the Haggadah in English. He wrote it in English, which is one of the reasons it's such an important and useful work. And the notes are extraordinary. To this day, I use the notes in that book when I'm doing research. It's just a major piece of scholarship. It's unmatched by anybody. Ginsberg wrote an introduction to the Palestinian Talmud. And the Yerushalmi, what we call today again the Yerushalmi, the Jerusalem Talmud. And there he said that Babylonian texts deal with superstition. Palestinian Yerushalmi texts don't have superstitions in them. Babylonian texts are filled with superstitious practices, which is true. I mean, I think that was a very insightful comment that he made. I don't think that that extends to this. I don't think that this is in the realm of what I would call superstition. Superstition is the kind of thing where you take three tails of a cat, and at 9 o'clock at night, you say the following words on them, and you light a fire, you blow it out, and then you go for a walk around the block, and tomorrow somebody dies. You had that in the Bavli. You did have stuff like that in the Bavli. You had none of that in your Yerushalmi. But this kind of thing with the dead talk, that you have, again, not frequently, but it's there.
Now, this superstition in the Babylonian Talmud and the French, the fact that they were surrounded by the Babylonian culture.
That's what he claims, and I think it makes perfect sense. It was a result of being the culture of the Babylonians, where this was a basic part of their culture. The basic part of their culture. Okay. I want to read a little bit further in the note. Look at the English note number 5. He was punished for slighting Rav Hamanuna. Right? Here, you gave me a good logical explanation for... I had two good logical explanations for why his teeth fell out. Right? Here is a different one. He was punished for slighting Rav Hamanuna, or for slighting Rav Hamanuna's father, who was also a worthy person, right? By saying that Rabba Babar Huna, he had an important father. That's a way of saying the other guy didn't have such an important father. It seems puzzling, though, that the Arab deserved to be punished. After all, it is logical that if the sages are equal, the one with superior ancestry should be given precedence. So the Talmud is, in a way, agreeing with the Arab. Right? The Arab is right. The Arab is right. The conclusion is drawn by the Arab where he said, Bidin, that this is logical. It is logical. He was right. In fact, he was right. Moreover, his judgment was accepted as correct since the camel of Rabba Barav Huna did proceed first. Maharshal explains that although having a great father is a factor, being versed in Torah is paramount, as emerges from the Gemara Munachot 53a. And since each sage sought to honor the other for his knowledge of Torah, introducing the factor of Rabba Babar Huna's ancestry was considered a slight to Rabba Hamanuna's Torah scholarship. In other words, why do you have to bring up the father for it? You know, these are two guys, both good scholars, and they still have to be... treated with respect. Another explanation is that the Arab, by using the words Gavra bar Gavra, a man the son of a man, and not Gavra Rabba bar Gavra Rabba, great man, the son of a great man, slighted all the sages, including Rabba Bar Rav Huna and his father, as well as Rav Hamanuna. However, the greatest slight was to Rav Hamanuna's father, for the Arab implied that he was not even in the category of a man. I think most of those explanations are just ridiculous, to tell you the truth. This is the kind of stuff you expect in the art scroll, where it's not literal. It's not sensitive to literary language. First of all, you don't need all these explanations. Mm-hmm. Not everything has to make such childish moral sense. It's better not to have an explanation for a story like that, to sort of just be left wondering. But I think, frankly, the two explanations that we gave here were, to my mind, much more based than
Steinsaltz goes along with the notion that he was punished because of his daring to speak out as in front of all of these men who were wiser than he was.
But he leads the camel, he has the right.
He who leads the camel is usually not the great man.
Yeah, but if you want to cross the bridge, you need somebody to pull the camel.
The most interesting thing is the camel is considered the gold standard. Because the camel is the only one who holds the truth, according to the
conservative. It's fascinating, and it's very interesting. It's a little bit like the donkey in the back, in the Torah. Bilam's donkey. The animals seem to be smarter than the people. And every once in a while you have that kind of reversal. And this is not the last time that you... That's not a hard time to understand most of it.
I agree with you that I think this is sort of... this embellished, it could be sort of like a comic relief. This type of thing. And this embellishment of everything has some profound meaning.
Correct.
Is...
sometimes you even have to know when to laugh.
That's right.
And some people don't know when to laugh. After everything, has got to be a reason.
It was very comical about, you know, when the pillar, they went into the tomb and there was fire and the guy threw
good
the
story.
Casket and
ran out.
Okay.
There's another comment?
Since it comes immediately after the story of the burial of Rabbu himself, suggests perhaps that the Arab who was involved in the story was around for the previous burial and observed the way in which Rav Huna was treated, the people coming out of the city to meet the caravan and so on. So even what you, I agree with what you both said, because you would like to burst out laughing when you hear the story, but it would be a little embarrassing if it has a moral message to it. But maybe the story says, just because you're a hanger-on, you know what's going on, doesn't give you the authority to voice an opinion, particularly when you have scholars, sages around. So better just keep your opinion to yourself. And even though you would like to laugh, you're embarrassed if you start.
Especially when it's a religious book, you figure, well, they know more than I do, you know, it must be a serious thing. I just don't get it.
Quite funny.
Okay. All right, now we go a little bit further. They finally get to their destination. They're being buried hot down in the land of Israel. And we hear the eulogies. Patach alei hahu yenuka. A certain youngster began the eulogy over Rav Hamanuna. And that seems to be, that's what Rashi suggests, that this first one is Rav Hamanuna. Geza yishishim ala mi bavel. The imo sefer milchamot. Kap v'kipod huchpalu lir'ot v'shod v'shevera ba nishin ar. Katzaf al olamo v'chamas mimenu nifashot. Sameach behem kechala chadasha v'chev aravot sas v'samach. Bevo elav nefesh naki v'tzadik. That's the eulogy. Let's take it part by part. Geza yeshishim ala mibavel. Geza yeshishim means the stock of the elders. Now, it could be that we're talking about, for example, in the book of Isaiah, Geza ben Yishai. When we talk about in the vision of the lion lying down with the lamb, right, that is from the stock of Jesse, from the stock of Jesse. That's the way this phrase is used. So, Geza Yeshishim, Yashish, I think in modern Hebrew you still use Yashish, don't you? It's used as a synonym for Zaken. For Zaken. Remember that Zaken in rabbinic Hebrew doesn't only mean somebody who is old, but an elder. It means it's a synonym for rabbis.
I think Yashish is older than the Zaken in general.
Yeah. In a Talmud, Yashish can be used as a synonym for Zaken. The way you say Zakenim in Aramaic is Kashishim. Kashishe. So Geza Yashishim would mean Scion of Rabbis, we would say in good English, I think. S-C-I-O-N. Scion of Rabbis. Alani Bavel came up from Babylonia. The Imo Sefer Milchamot. And with him a book of wars. I assume Sefer Milchamot probably means the Torah. Because, remember, in the Torah, in the book of Numbers, there is a section that is called the Sefer Milchamot Hashem. This is the book of the wars of the Lord. It's actually in the Torah itself. So I assume that this is a poetic way of referring to the Torah as the book of Milchamot. Ka'at v'kipod huchpalu. Ka'at v'kipod, those are two types of birds. Huchpalu have been doubled. There, I think, and the notes really support this, ka'at v'kipod probably is referring to whalers. Remember that in the time of the Talmud there were professional whalers. What a whaler is, these were women usually who were paid to wail at funerals. And so that there was a musical accompaniment to a funeral procession, which was the women who would wail at the processions. Niyalalot, correct. Say that? What does that mean?
Women who mourn the Tammuz.
The Tammuz, the god Tammuz.
The Babylonian god Tammuz.
Interesting.
Professional women.
So you have mention made of women who do this in this Masachet. You will see that elsewhere in the Talmud. And this seems to be something that was done. So that's what I think, Ka'at v'kipod huchpalu, that is to say, there were twice as many whalers. Either because there were two rabbis, or this is a way simply of emphasizing the great amount of grief, even at the one rabbi. Okay? Ka'at v'kipod huchpalu, lir'ot b'shod b'shever haba mishin ar, to see the plunder and brokenness which came from Shinar. Eretz Shinar in the Bible is Babylonia. That's the way Babylonia is referred to in the book of Genesis. And it is used that way poetically. So a brokenness has come from Babylonia, namely the rabbis who died have been brought up to the land of Israel.
Shod v'shever, it's to wear the translate to gzila.
To gzila?
Ligzol.
Ligzol.
So the way I translate it, lirot v'shod v'shever rabam mishenar, means that basically because you said there are two huge rabbis,
they've been stolen away? Stolen away from Babylonia. Very nice, that's good. That's
Shod v'shever is two words.
Correct, you're right. They are always, they're used together as a pattern, Shod v'shever. Very nice.
Lishdod and Lishbor, it's like to steal and to break, or right. To mark it. Lishbor is Mashbila
Tzarkan. That's also true, Mashbila Tzarkan, that's very good.
It's just a phrase for destruction.
Right? It could be either. Either one is good. I like both of these. Okay? Katzaf al olamo, he was angry at his world, meaning God. The chamas mimenu nefashot, and plundered souls from it, namely these rabbis. But he rejoices with them like a new bride. Right? He has these friendly souls that are back in his place, in his court, under his kuppah. Right? That's how the souls of the tzaddikim return to God. Rochev aravot sas v'samach. He who rides on the heavens. Aravot is one of the names of one of the heavens, of the seven heavens. He who rides upon the heavens is joyful and glad. Bevo'elav nefesh naki v'tzadik. With the coming to him of a soul that is pure and righteous. Okay? It is very lovely that God rejoices when the souls of the rabbis come back to him. Kinach nafshe de Ravina. When Ravina died, patach alei hahu saftana. And here there is a technical term for somebody who is a maspid, somebody who is a eulogizer. And in Aramaic, that person is called a safdana. Safdana. So when Ravina dies, the eulogizer began the eulogy over him as follows. Tamarim hinil rosh. Hanil rosh. Well, it's hard to... here it's pointed. Tamarim hanil rosh. That is to say, palm trees, wave your tops. I'm not sure it means that. Could be the same letters could be pointed, he kneel, that the palm trees waved. It could be past tense. The palm trees waved their tops, which is to say, the palm tree, which is pictured as being straight up. Sadika tamar yivrach. All right? The tzaddik, like a palm tree, will flourish. Right? The sense of that is that it's straight up, straight, tzaddik, yashar, right? And its top is up there. Now he knew that they bend over. Right? That they bend over. The palm trees are bent now. Because the rabbi has died, so since the rabbi is like a palm tree straight, now the palm tree is mourning as well. The palm tree is leaning over. That's my interpretation of it. So, Tamarim Inil Rosh Al Tzadik Atamar, because of the tzaddik who was like a palm tree. Nashim Leilot Kiyamim. Nasim Leilot Kiyamim. Let us make nights as days. That is to say, we won't be able to sleep at night because we have lost, the loss is so great that we have experienced. Al Nasim Leilot Kiyamim. For over he who made nights like days. Okay, because he studied all night. The tzaddik stayed up all night studying. So that was his virtue and his beauty. So that's what he did. Now let me see if I can read this to you in rhyme. Tmarim anil rosh al tzadika tamar. Nasim leilot kiyamim al nasim leilot kiyamim. You'll see several of these eulogies are in rhyme couplets. And I think that you have to read them that way. They actually have a rhythm and a rhyme to them. Not all of them, but this one does, I think. Read it again. Tmarim anil rosh al tzadik tamar. Nasim leilot kiyamim al nasim leilot kiyamim. Okay? Very nice the way they do that. Okay? It's a play on words. It's a play on words, and it's done with rhythm and rhyme. Now comes another eulogy. Amar le Rav Ashi le Bar Kippot. Kippok. Rav Ashi said to this other person called Bar Kippok. Now, throughout the English here, you'll see that Bar Kippok is assumed to be the person's name. It may very well be. But I would just note to you that the page before, remember the name of the bird? There were two birds, Ka'at and Kippod. So that was Kippod, and this is Kippok. Kippok. So I think really that this could be a scribal error, or it could just be a slight difference in pronunciation. And a Bar Kippok, then, is either a wailer or a eulogizer. Right? But it's a technical term taken from the name of the bird. Taken from the name of the bird. They don't understand it that way in the translation. They understand that that's simply his name. It's just too much of a coincidence to me that these words, they're just too much alike and they're too unusual. There's nobody named Kippok in the Talmud.
No.
What?
That helps you.
Yeah, exactly. No, that's not a name that you ever hear. I think it must really be Kippok. Hahu Yoma Mayamat. Now here, it's not at all clear what Rav Ashi is saying. Either he's saying something that refers to something that happened up above, Hahu Yoma, on that day, Mayamart, what did you say? You know, it could be that he's asking this person, on that day of the previous death that was mentioned up above, what did you say? That could be it. Or, the way most of the commentators take this, Rav Ashi is saying, Hahu Yoma means when I die. He's referring to his own death. And he would never refer to his own death by saying, when I die. He can't say that. In Rabbinic Hebrew, and certainly in Aramaic, you never really say anything bad that pertains directly to any present company. You can't say those things. So you always speak in euphemisms. So, Hahu Yoma, that day, would be the way to refer to the day of my death. Okay? So in other words, when you're going to be called upon to give a eulogy on that day, what will you say? What will you say? Amale, Bar Kippok says that. Amina, I will say, In the arazim nafla shal hevet, ma yasu ezove kir. Liviatan mechaka ho Allah, ma yasu degei lekak, ma yasu mei gevin. No, binechal shotef nafla chaka, ma yasu mei gevin. I will translate this. This is the form of eulogy that he's projecting that he will say. If a spark fell upon cedar trees. If a spark has fallen upon cedar trees, mayasu ezovekir, what will happen to the hyssops of the wall? In other words, a hyssop in the Bible and in the Talmud, ezov, the hyssop is the humble bush. And you have to keep that in mind, actually, when the Bible itself uses hyssop. Exactly, like with the red heifer, like correct. And when is that for? Exactly, the dorpas. You use hyssop for that too. Hyssop is in all likelihood chosen because it's a humble bush. It's a small bush, it's a low bush, it's a fragile bush. Okay.
And it's not planted.
It's not planted, that's true. It just
grows
well.
Do we know what it is?
Oh, yeah. It's well known. There's a wonderful article written about it by Professor Noga Ruveni, who was one of the great experts on Israeli trees. And he studied the hyssop and just really in order to learn the biblical imagery, wanted to see what the use of this was. And what I'm telling you comes from Ruveni's conclusions about the use of hyssop.
it a desert? It's a desert plant?
It's like a moss.
Yep.
It's a moss?
Well, it's more substantial than a moss, but it is a desert plant, although it's many places in Israel. I don't know where it is outside of Israel. But if a great cedar, another, the rabbis, of course, are compared to the cedars of Lebanon. Right? They are, again, straight. A cedar tree, when I was in Israel last week, I was looking at cedar trees. There was a whole planting of cedars. And the cedars in the Middle East are different from the cedars that we have here. We have cedars up in the state of Maine. They don't look, they're sort of like it. I mean, they're sort of a straight tree, but a cedar tree, it has much more breadth to it, a New England cedar. The cedars in the Middle East are very narrow trees. And they just go up like this. They're like arrows, almost. And they look rather striking. And, of course, the tree that is most like them is the palm tree. Because the palm tree also is a straight tree. It's a straight tree that just goes straight up. So the rabbis are compared with both. They're straight and they're tall.
Is this the quotation from the Tanakh?
Which?
Imbar and Nafla Shasha.
No, no. That's
because there's a Hebrew song.
Yes,
and I would be surprised that they took it from the Talmud.
It could be. That's the song.
Imbar as in Nafala Hashashat Maya Gidu Ezer Bahar.
Yeah, we used to sing that.
Yeah. So Ezer Bahar, do you know it?
I'm trying to recall the tune, but I know we used as a child. We used
Imbar
to
sing. As in
very interesting. So it's exactly these words. So it never occurred to me. I didn't realize that was used. Maybe it is a quote. But don't put it past the Zionist writers that they knew Talmud. I mean, they might not have all known Talmud the way they knew Bible, but it's possible that they come from
days.
They're nice like days. Okay. Let's just make a note. Yes, sir.
Stories about the eulogies, and there's a set of rules around the eulogy that we're going to get to at the end of this, or do we?
Much of it is simply abstracted from this. As in a lot of things in the Talmud, it takes the next generation to say, well, why are some of them good and why are some of them bad? What are the principles we learn? Very little of that is articulated here. Some of it, but not what you'd like, not as much as you'd like, not as much as the next generation of rabbis wanted as well, because they had to then make decisions about what the issues were. Okay? So, Maya Asur Ezobeakir, Livyatan Bechaka Hoala. This, of course, this is from, when it was 17, this was committed in Lebanon. Expression the flash shall have it a flame fall removes the valley fire. In terms of Eish Elohim naflam in Hashamayim, just trying to see whether they answer your question, so. The word shall ever sound in Song of Songs, here he gives a whole bunch of biblical sources, but none of them is the source. I mean, it's not the word shall have it appears here, and that's not what we're looking for. You actually, this song apparently is these words. It's made up of these words.
No, it's a song.
Yeah.
Yeah,
that's fascinating. Yeah. Very interesting. Goes on then, Livyatan bechakaola. If a Leviathan was lifted up from the sea with a fish hook, right? Maya su de gay rekak. And the translation is good. What do the small fry do? Mm-hmm. In other words, if a fish hook is that effective that it can pick up a Leviathan, right? The rest, they're all just grist for the mill. They don't have a chance to live. The Leviathan, again, being the rabbis. In other words, the rabbi dies. The rest of you have no chance. Right? If with all of his righteousness, the Lord takes him away, what about all the people who are not so righteous? Okay. Now, this if you can imagine listening to a eulogy like this, just hold on for 1 minute. It keeps going like this. The Nachal Shotef Nafla Chaka, into a rushing stream. Chaka, dryness, they translate that as? That's not dryness. It's still in the fish hook. In other words, if a fish hook can be successful in a rushing stream where the fish are going by so quickly, then how much more so? Maya so megevim. What will the state of the fish be in a pond where the water is stagnant? Where, if you've ever been fishing, and you know, sometimes you see there's a tremendous amount of activity going on. It's hard to the fish. You're afraid the fish won't find your hook. They won't see your bait. And yet, if you're ever in the circumstance, I remember once I was fishing in a lake in somewhere, and I saw the fish down below. So I go, oh, I got him this time. So I drop it down, you know, just right there, and I got him. I caught the fish. So, but the truth was, that wasn't really such a challenge, you know. I think, oh, it was good for me because I'm not up to a challenge. But all right. So again, here it's the same sort of imagery that when the hard one to catch is caught, what is it like for everybody else? Now, here, Bar Kippok's eulogy is criticized. Amar le Bar Avin. Bar Avin, the commentary says another eulogy, said to Bar Kippok, Chas v'shalom, God forbid. Chas v'shalom. Yechaka v'shalhevet b'tzadiki amina. God forbid that I would ever mention a fish hook or a flame with regard to the righteous. Now, this is a way of saying that, you know, when you're saying that, when you're talking about the righteous, you just don't talk about it. To me, there's something much more to this. I think that it's just a really bad eulogy. Because, first of all, it's really not saying, it's using the death of the... Exactly. You're praising the one who has died at the expense of everybody else who's there.
That's right.
And you're going to make that... Is that the way to make them feel good?
Insult your guests.
And they come to the funeral for the great rabbi and you make them leave, you know, going crazy. If he got it, you better watch out now. What kind of eulogy is that? That's not eulogy. I mean, it's at the expense of the assembled. And that's not the proper way to deliver a eulogy. So it's interesting here, you see that he's criticized. This Bar Kippok is criticized by Bar Avin.
But he's also a eulogist.
So yes.
Like he's in competition.
Well, that's true.
So I wanted to ask about what is the interpretation of how eulogists were selected? And were this a group like a group of poets that they would select the one that was going to be the most emotive? And, you know, what was the... Is this a profession?
Yes and no. I mean, we don't know an awful lot about it. You're seeing most of what we know about it in these pages of the Talmud. So that they were professionals. My assumption is that they were paid for their work, but I don't really know that for sure. I don't think we have evidence to that effect. You do see that they were competing with each other. They were criticizing each other. There was give and take with them. And I assume that also that probably more than one of them was hired to do the job. Just because you see occasionally more than one has something to say. More than that, I don't know that I can say. It'd be interesting to compare this to other cultures,
no.
though.
But it doesn't seem as if they've been selected based upon their personal relationship with the individual.
That's correct. It does not seem that way. It seems rather that they're being selected, or at least the context here is one of expertise.
Their ability to create these images.
And correct. And you see the imagery of the previous one that we read, and even this one, the imagery is not so bad. It's really quite nice. The imagery in the previous one was great.
The metaphors are...
Yeah, exactly.
So, but I took it a little bit differently, why he was criticizing him. Not so much for the point of insulting the people, but just when you have the sage to conjure up a mental image of the fire or a mental image of a fish hook, that those are jarring.
That's good.
In the context.
That's what the commentators are saying. You're right. That's what Rashi says. It's just inappropriate. It's just too jarring. That when you're dealing, it's an issue of kavod, of honoring a person, and you can't use jarring images because it takes away from a person's honor.
Are there rules of who can eulogize today?
No. And there are customs, but it would be too much to say there are rules. We've seen that go through a transition just the years I've been in rabbinate. When I started as a rabbi, nobody but the rabbi would ever speak. Today, you're lucky if you hear the rabbi.
Yeah.
Or maybe not, depends. But the whole context of eulogizing has shifted today. Interesting to see those things happening, but then it's not really governed by rules. It is governed by a certain amount of tradition now.
I don't remember who or where or anything, but I'm sure in Latin some of the writings there were eulogies written down, and they would criticize each other in what they said about the person that they were eulogizing. It was sort of a common thing, as I recall. I don't remember where it's just in the back.
It's in the middle of the night, you remember, write it down.
Okay.
Because I'd like to know. Because it occurs to me this would be a terrific article. It'd be a really nice article to see where these kinds of eulogies, what the... They must be dealing with certain conventions of the Hellenistic world. And it would be nice to have kind of information.
I mean, the mourners, the whole pattern.
Not correct.
The mourners start, those are on the...
I'm not that...
Not cave paintings, but hieroglyphics.
I'm not that familiar with the Greek and Roman sources. That's why if any of you know or can point me to them, I would be grateful.
You don't have to belabor it, but I was struck by how unmodern this notion of the high heavens, or he who rides the top high heavens is glad and rejoices. I don't think we suggest that today. But is this good theology?
Yes, I mean, that's classic. It's from the Psalms. I believe that phrase is borrowed from the Psalms, Rochev Ba'aravot, and it's certainly in the Talmud. It's in
so worthy souls. Join God.
Mm-hmm.
I guess there are levels of heaven.
The levels of heaven, that's in the Talmud. People have written about that, that there are different levels of heaven. Of course, it's become very popular, actually, because it got picked up in the Kabbalah. And you'll hear people talking a lot today. These modern people are interested in Kabbalah without knowing too much. Talk a lot about the different levels of the heavens.
I have heard in Christian milieu this notion of being happy that the soul has gone to join because of her maker.
Mm-hmm. Well, you've got that here too. I mean, we don't have theology like that, but it is more than theology, you have imagery. I think I would be more comfortable saying, I don't want to say there's a theology of joining God, but there certainly is a poetry of joining God. And to me, that's a difference. I found, since I've given a few eulogies in my time, the poetry of things that you say about death sometimes has a great reality to it. Whereas to go from there to articulate a theology from the poetry gets you into trouble. And I know I do that myself. I will say things in a eulogy that I wouldn't want to have to teach in a theology class. But in a eulogy, it's right. There's just a certain coming together of realities and ideas. But it's really poetry, it's not theology.
It seems, if the translation is correct, it seems strange that it's not considered inappropriate for someone to ask this eulogizer what he's going to say about him. It's almost,
get a contract
before. Right, I mean, it's
the whole thing's over.
It's like trying to find the guy who wrote the New York Times obit for you, where you go to take him out for dinner or something, you know.
In my years in the rabbinate, I've once in a while had funerals which were written by the deceased. where people will, where the deceased will, first of all, it's not all that rare, where the deceased will write the procedures, everything that's going to happen. This one will speak, and that one will speak, and that's what the other person speaks, and it's all on a piece of paper. I go to somebody's house and I say, well, my father left us the funeral, and the funeral was going to be as follows, you know. And he wrote it down all in his own hand, and so everybody is chosen ahead of time. And one of the thoughts that I've had, you know, is how much did he talk it over with them? You know, did he discuss with them what they're going to say, or are these sure bets? Just him trust the others. You know, if we're up for grabs, it could have been a problem. Or he didn't trust the rabbi, you know. Or it's the personality. I remember one time somebody wrote, and he wrote all the music. This was a musical person, a lot of music, and every piece of music was there, it was all recorded, and it was a few years ago, so it's not like today. And then the last recording was this person singing. So it was very spooky, and I thought most inappropriate too. But that's what it felt like, you know, because you have modern technology, you could do that.
Go to the cemetery in L.A. It's all over the place.
You kidding?
You get pictures.
Pictures?
You just press the button, you get the video comes on, and everything else like that.
Really?
Yeah. Did they advertise on the radio? Mm-hmm. Okay, hi, I'm dead now. Well, come to the Forest Lawn and hear this.
So you don't have to hire anybody anymore.
That's like forever.
A very prominent person who is Jewish, and the family has put together a DVD of the guy's life and has shown it to him shortly before his death, and then they played the DVD at his funeral. So he was there, living common.
I think the custom of writing down exactly what you want in terms of funeral, to the extent of what you want to say, is a long-standing custom. Okay, in any number of traditions, is certainly a very, very common European tradition.
Even here, the ethical will.
That's different.
I know it's something different, but it's one of those ones.
But it's so different that it really makes a different point. The ethical will it's always referring to is where people write, oh, I want not just where my money is going, but I want you to be a tzaddik, and I want you to study Torah, and I want you to be nice to your mother and to your sister.
I want you to be guilty.
You know.
You can do it one line. I don't have to spell it all out.
But that's different. I mean, what Mark is referring to is, I think, something different.
I think the most noted one was Lord Mountbatten, who was the former commander of the British forces against the Japanese during World War II, and always held it against them. Okay, he was killed by the Irish fishing with his grandson, unfortunately.
Political killing?
Yeah.
Yes. But he always, the IRA blew up the fishing boat, but he always disliked the Japanese. They felt he killed too many of his men. And whenever they were in town for the ceremony, he always happened to be in the country. In the end, he had the last words, because in his funeral instructions, he said, no Japanese.
He was the Viceroy of India.
The Viceroy of India, the last Viceroy of India.
Very similar.
I missed something. You were talking about the levels of heaven. Is that element in here?
It's implied by this phrase that said Aravot. Where was it? Rochev Aravot, right. Right, Rochev Aravot, which was on 25b2, 1, 2, 3 lines down from the top. Rochev, he who rides atop high heavens. It's just the word Aravot is actually one of the words used in the Talmud for one of the levels of heaven.
One of the levels of heaven.
Yes.
What I'm interested in is you mentioned Kabbalah, which is very, very complex and has many, many levels of heaven, but also Milton's Paradise Lost. I mean, is there a connection? How did this whole concept of an entire civilization around heaven, different levels? I mean, Paradise Lost is nothing but that.
It's a very big thing in the Christian tradition.
Oh, yeah, but
Christianity is a very big thing. I would say, in comparison, you will find some of that in the Talmud. It's not, we don't have a Dante. We don't have a Dante who wrote on the different levels. We just don't have anything. It's not part of our tradition. But it's also not completely absent. That's all I would. I wouldn't say anything more than that.
Shamayim is a plural word.
I wouldn't go too far with that. Now, let's get to Barabin's reply, because Bar Kippok asks Barabin, my comrade, what would you say if you were going to eulogize him? Okay, he criticized Bar Kippok. So what would you say? Amina. Now he then says what he would say. Okay, you see the alternative. Excuse me. B'chu la'avelim v'lo la'aveda shehi li menucha v'anu la'anacha. That, first of all, get the just the poetry of the thing. It's pure poetry. It's rhymes and it's perfect rhythm. B'chu la'avelim v'lo la'aveda shehi li menucha v'anu la'anacha. Okay? Perfect piece of poetry. B'chul avelim, cry for the mourners, and not for the one who is lost. Shehi li menucha, for it, namely the one who is lost, is going for its rest. Menucha, its rest. Va'anu la'anacha, but we are left to sadness. And we are left to weeping. Now, because we've lost this great loss. Okay, so that was Bar Avin's eulogy.
One permitted to borrow that today?
You can borrow anything else.
There's no life.
Okay, there's no copyright.
If copyright is run, is it considered inappropriate or demeaning to somebody? A blessed memory?
Not at all. If you can quote the Talmud, it's always considered to be a higher... it's a compliment.
Circle that one.
Okay. But...
Life is fully alone, no?
You'll never be copied already.
You can put on a video. Put on your DVD if you like.
DVD. The world is yours. The world is yours. Okay, but go on to the next page now, 25b3. Now you see Ravashi's reaction. Chalash darpe alayhu. Ravashi got upset from both of them. So he didn't like either of these eulogies. And he didn't like the last one either. Okay? Now just take a look at the last one. Let's see what could be wrong with that. The Hula Abelim. I cry for the mourners and not for the lost object, for it is going to peace and we are going to sigh. Now let's see, 22. Do we have any commentary on that? Yes, here, go over 23 of the next page. Even Bar-Avin's suggested eulogy was inappropriate, for he described the soul as a lost object. I'm not sure. But the soul of a righteous person is not lost at all. Rather, it remains alive eternally in the world to come. Rabbi Shlomo ben Ayatom explains further that instead of eagerly offering Rav Ashi samples of their planned eulogies, they should have told him, may you live to be 120. In other words, the real problem was that they answered his request. He says, what are you going to say at my eulogy? What should you say? You should say, may you live to be 120. That should be the answer. Okay. You don't answer the question directly. You're not supposed to answer the question directly. I think that's a good possibility here, that they were both wrong, that they both took it too seriously. According to the explanation that Bar Kippok and Bar Avin were describing to Rav Ashi, the eulogies that they intended to offer for Ravina, that was up above, the reason they became dejected was that they compared Ravina to a cedar and all others, including Rav Ashi, to insignificant hyssops of the wall. That's not true at all. That's a bad interpretation. Yes.
Okay. Is there going to be more about a lot of bond? What is the lot of bond, all of this?
Is there going to be more? You'll see it. It'll come in again and again. Realize that very little was just said in what we read. Most of it was said in the English translation.
Most of this is
being interpolated.
Okay.
Okay. It's not actually in the text. The text it says the Hiliminucha.
Okay.
All it says is Hiliminucha. The English says so the soul is destined for peace in the Garden of Eden. That's not what the Talmud said. That's what the English commentary says. It tries to flesh out the whole thing because it knows a lot more than the Talmud does. It has a concept, you know, later on the commentators begin to elaborate the notion of a world to come, and it's called Gan Eden and so on. Though there is mention of this in the Talmud, there's not any mention of it in the Talmud, there is no mention of it here.
Will there be a lot of mention of it?
No, it's not a lot. There's some mention of Talmud of it.
Okay. Because yeah. I should think that would be a big part of preparing the all these things that you should or shouldn't do.
Well,
to prepare
it
for
is
that.
True and it's not true. I mean, yes, you would think that it would be. One thing that's interesting is that we see relatively little of that. Particularly in a context like this, you might have expected a lot of it.
Yeah, I just remembered that I thought I did.
Yeah, right. You might have expected a lot of it, and it's just not here. I mean, there's a smidgen of it, but not as much. I tell you, if this book were written by a good Christian, it would be a lot different. Which is not to say that there isn't some commonality between the two, but it would surely be a lot different in terms of its emphasis. What'd you say, Jay?
It would be
no halacha. Okay. Okay, so now look what he does. Rav Ashi chalash date. He got upset from them. Felt dejected. That's not what it means. Chalash date means he got upset. The itapuch karayhu. And since he got upset with them, he, in effect, expressed his anger at them, the itapuch karayhu, and their feet became inverted. Here we go again.
Just laughing away writing.
The itapuch karayhu. Hahu yoma. On that day, when I assume the commentary is correct here, when Rav Ashi finally dies, lo atu la'aspade, they didn't come to eulogize him.
They couldn't walk.
So the commentators say that, of course, they couldn't walk. How could they come? They couldn't walk. Number one. Number two, they were so mad at him for ruining their feet that they wouldn't have eulogized him. Okay? The third possibility, of course, is that in effect he had told them that he doesn't like their eulogies. Right.
Well, the first thing you can happen to is a eulogizer who stands up to deliver.
No pizza stand-up. Okay. And just to finish this little piece here, the final comment is, Bahainu Diamar Ravashi. Now, this is the same Ravashi, so this, in a way, should have come a little bit before. And this is the meaning of what Ravashi says when he says, Lo bar kipok chalitz, v'lo bar avin chalitz. Neither bar kipok nor bar avin is fit for chalitza. Now, what that means is, you remember there is a biblical procedure that is connected to the levirate marriage. It's called levirate marriage. In the Bible, and you see this in particular in the book of Ruth, in the Bible, if a man dies without a child, that issue, and he dies, there's no issue, his brother is required to marry his widow.
The levirate marriage.
That's the levirate marriage. Okay, that's a biblical procedure of marriage, in order to be sure that his name is passed on. Right, his brother has to take the wife. You're dealing with a society here which is polygamous, could be polygamous. However, he could refuse to do that. He could refuse to do it. There is a procedure of refusal called chalitza.
Release.
Chalitza means chalitza, what happens is that he has a shoe on, and the shoe is removed. She removes the shoe. That is a releasing of him, and it's an embarrassment that he's not willing to be responsible to his brother. But it's a way out. He may not want to do it. For a variety of reasons. The assumption, of course, is that she wants that. That she's in a much more difficult position because she's a widow. It's much more difficult for a widow to get married than for a woman who has never been married. So the assumption is that it would be in her favor to do this. But the procedure of chalitza is that the way it's mentioned in the Torah, the shoe must be removed from the bottom of the foot. Now in this case, it means basically that the foot is here, the shoe. The shoe has to be on the bottom of the foot. Their feet were upside down. And so their shoes were on the top. And therefore Rav Ashi said, they will never be able to perform the chalitza. Okay? So that's his way of saying, as a result of all of this, this deformity that took place as a result of his being angry at them, they will never be able to perform chalitza. So was their foot turned over. That's very heavy. It's you can see the level of anger. He was apparently very angry at them to react so strongly. Usually when the rabbis are angry, somebody has said something to, which was, you say in English, a pagam in their kavod. Why would you say, how do you say that? That's not exactly English. How do you say pagam in somebody's kavod? Give me a good way to say it in English. They've insulted their dignity. They've insulted their dignity. And the rabbis are very concerned with their dignity. I assume it was both personality, it was cultural. The ostensible reason for it is that you're not insulting their dignity, you're insulting the dignity of the Torah. Okay? Whether it's that alone leaves it to your imagination. But that's when you see this level of anger, it usually is that. So it's obvious that Rav Ashi really felt that they were insulting him. But it wasn't only that they weren't doing a job. He wouldn't have had this level of response. Rather, the content of what they said was an insult to him. Okay?
It's possible that the chalitza was one of the funeral customs or something? Not just, why chalitza in this context?
Because it's an indication of how deformed their feet were.
Yeah,
that's the whole purpose of this, is to simply underline the power of his curse.
Yeah,
he gave it to
him. Deformed feet could hinder in many other ways, but why chalitza?
Because when you're talking among rabbis, they're not going to talk about real things, they're going to talk about legal issues. Metaphors will be metaphors drawn from the legal tradition.
So
that's not unusual.
It's not a
No, I don't remember. We found that we did read a funeral custom called chalitza, which meant the bearing of the shoulder.
Right.
That was different. I don't think that has any relation to this at all.
The imagery is devastating.
It's terrible.
I really thought.
I think Rav Ashi is not a very sagacious sage. He asked a very inappropriate question. He said, like, "What would you say? What will you say when I die?" And then they say something he doesn't like, and then he
sometimes those are tough. You know, some of you, Barry, you sit on a faculty. Faculty meet can be very, very difficult.
Words count. And bad words have a long life.
Correct. And people who are masters of words sometimes are masters of using bad words.
Say, people forget what you say and people forget what you do, but people never forget how you make them feel.
Mm-hmm. Quite correct. Okay. Ladies and gentlemen, to be continued.
Thank you. The other thing is that these two people didn't understand the depth of the fear.
Well, possibly that's right.